Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, you're listening to Film Talks On Air. This is Jane Ross, host of the podcast, and my special guest today is Annie Collins. Welcome, Annie.
Kia ora, Jane. Very nice to be here with you.
Oh, it's an absolute delight to be talking with you, Annie. I met you for the very first time earlier this year in May. You joined us for the Wairarapa Film Festival, which I was just delighted. I was delighted to have you in the audience and delighted to have you at Vincent Ward's Masterclass as well. And yeah, wasn't that a fun weekend? I'm really, really hoping I can have you back and do a bit of a retrospective on some of your films for the film festival programming next year.
Well, that would certainly be a real privilege. So I'll have to start hunting out my favourites, I guess.
Yeah, I've got a couple of my favourites, and right now I'm in discussion with the very good people at the film preservation team at Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision. They are hoping to have the full restoration of The Neglected Miracle completed in time for next year's film festival.
Well, that would be stunning. It's a very prescient film, and working for Barry Barclay was quite an education for me.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I never sadly got to meet Barry, but I've made a point of including Barry's films in every year of the film festival. It was the fourth year this year, and in fact, in the very first year, I screened Graham Tuckett's documentary, which you were the editor for The Camera on the Shore. And I started at that point, Annie, because I thought, if anyone didn't know who Barry Barclay was, I was going to make it my mission to spread that word as far and as wide as I could. And I felt so deeply gratified with starting with that documentary, giving an overview to him and his philosophy and his ways of working, but also how important he was and how important he is still. And I had the joy of having Graham here to talk to the audience. And when it came time to ask questions, there was a man in the audience that put up his hand and said, "Why doesn't everyone in New Zealand know who Barry Barclay is?" And everyone was quiet. And I just thought, yes, I'm doing the right thing, because that's how I feel too. I want everyone to know. Yeah.
Yeah. The work that was done, that you've done by showcasing Barry, is really important, because I have come across in the last few months of I've come across some young Māori filmmakers, and certainly young Pākehā filmmakers, who said, "Who's that?"
I know.
They didn't know who he was and what sort of part he played, let alone the sort of philosophy and intellectual rigour that he had.
Indeed. Did you – now, of course, I can invite you to be part of the Wairarapa Film Festival, but specifically because you were born here in Macedon. You grew up in Macedon, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Tell me about that. What was it like growing up here? Because, of course, Barry Barclay was born here as well. So I'm wondering if you ever crossed paths with him earlier on, but I really would love to know what it was like for you growing up here.
I didn't cross paths with Barry as I was growing up in Masterton, although we went to the same college. But the really interesting thing is about it is that the documentary film, which will be screening on August the 31st, Muddy Muddy, will be screening at the Regent Theatre. And my first 5 years, I lived next door to the Regent Theatre.
Did you?
Because my parents owned the bakery. At that stage, it was called Magnet Bakeries. And the bakehouse itself was down a long drive right beside that huge, big concrete wall of the Regent Theatre.
Mm, mm.
And so the Regent has always been, you know, played quite a part in my life, really. And the other thing is that the rest of my time in Masterton, I was my parents lived and I lived in Te Oriori Road. And just a couple of years ago, when I was driving back up to Masterton to see family members, and I saw the notice that's out there by Wainawa Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, Haere mai ki whaka oriori. And I was delighted to see that.
Yes.
I was delighted that we had claimed our original name, and it made sense of the road where I lived most of my growing years, Te Oriori Road. Although it's spelt differently, everything just connected.
You felt that connection. And
yep.
In fact, Barry Barclay at one point lived with his family on Te Oriori Road as well. So there's another connection that you might not have been aware of.
I was not aware of that. My goodness.
Now, here's another one. Here's where it starts to get spooky. The very first film and television production company to be established in Masterton actually had its headquarters upstairs above the Regent Theatre. And Barry, Barry had his first job as a cameraman working in that very studio, production house upstairs. So there you go.
Oh, my goodness. That's pretty amazing. And there's another connection as well, which is when I was – I worked for 4.5 years in the editorial department for Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings.
Mm.
And – the production had a whole – all of the sort of the special woven cloaks, et cetera, that the hobbits wore, and much of that sort of material was actually woven by Master Weave, which is a Masterton firm. And when I went – when I travelled up to Masterton, I wanted to get one of their beautiful throw rugs. And so I went to their factory and found that they were housed in the building that my father built for his second bakery in Lincoln Road.
Oh, okay. Yeah, where that's where they are now. I'm picturing exactly where that
that's
is.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Now, again, here's some more connections, but I'm getting a bit meta here. Right next door is Waiata House, and on that site was where the original or one of the town halls for Masterton once stood, and that is where actually some of the really, really early film screenings happened in Masterton. So, yeah, and the reason why it's called Waiata House, of course, is because of all the performances and screenings that used to happen in that town hall back in the day. So, yeah, it's a nice connection to have there too. Well,
yes, it is.
Was it an easy pathway for you entering into the film industry in New Zealand?
Easy pathway. It's interesting thinking about that. Not on the surface, it wasn't, because the only way to enter the industry back in 1976, when I was trying to do so, was through the National Film Unit, which was out at Miramar, or mm-hmm. Pacific Films, where Barry Barclay was working, or... a couple of the bigger production houses in Auckland, where I didn't want to go to. There were no film courses as such. And so I sort of went to these places and said, please can I learn to be a film editor with you? And Pacific Films weren't taking anybody on. National Film Unit took one look at me and said, no thanks. And television weren't hiring at that time either. So I went back to I had been tutored I've been in the graphic design course at the Wellington Polytechnic, and in the last year we had a film tutor come, and we made one small film with him, which I'd edited, that I should take a look and find out whether I could become an editor. And I went back to him. His name is Pat Cox. I went back to him and I said, nobody wants me, Pat. And he said, if you can keep yourself alive, I will train you.
Wow.
And that's what happened. And it's not a course that is particularly open to people these days. I was like the only person wandering around in Wellington looking for a job in film editing especially at that time. But these days there are film courses all over the country spitting out graduates, 18, 30 a year, all of them wanting jobs in the industry. So my path was very particular for that time and is not relevant anymore.
Yeah, I don't hear of people, sort of being mentored and trained under somebody in particular. You're right, you know, in the absence of a film school, you kind of had to find your mentors and find your own pathways, didn't you?
Yeah. And in order to do that, my keeping myself alive was I worked three jobs.
Wow.
And worked with Pat during the day.
Oh, gosh, Annie. That sounds hard and exhausting.
I was full of energy. Man, yeah. I wanted it, you know. Yeah. I wanted editing.
I understand that. I understand that drive. Yeah. Now, you very quickly... Looking at your screenography, moved into editing some pretty amazing film productions. I'm looking at Goodbye Pork Pie with Jeff Murphy. That was 1981. And then moving into Patu, which I want to sort of pause on because one of my favourite photographs, I wrote Brian Shennan's profile for New Zealand on Screen. He's a lovely, lovely man and was a really good friend of mine. And one of my favourite photographs, which I was saying to you earlier, is the one of you with Brian and Meta Tamita in the post-production studio for Patu. What was that like working with Meta Tamita?
It was like being next door to a furnace with the door open.
Gosh. Wow.
She had a formidable intellect and analysis. She is the most intelligent person I have ever worked with.
Gosh.
And she changed my whole perception of being a New Zealander. And I think the most important thing that she gave me was, if you can understand this, she gave me my culture. Because I'm Pākehā, and in order to work across culture with her coming from her perspectives and the way that she was brought up, I actually had to know who I was and what had shaped me and what had shaped my people's course in this country. And I learnt that in fairly short order. But it was probably the most precious gift that I have been given, that I turned around and looked at myself. And from that point on, I was then able to shoulder the responsibilities that you have as a person who lives in this country. And I was able then to give fully of my experience without excuses.
Yes.
With pride in many cases, but understanding fully the what effect one's upbringing has.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Your words are really resonating with me in particular, because there was a moment in time where I lived overseas for quite a number of years, all up. There was about 15 years where I was gone, and I came and went a little bit during that time. But when I returned at the end of 2010, I went down to Otago University to do my Master of Arts, and I specialised in New Zealand documentary, and I read widely on Barry Barclay and Merata Mita, and there were a couple of essays and books that changed me and changed my view of identity as a New Zealander as well. And it was The Soul and the Image by Merata Mita and Barry Barclay's Images of Dignity. And yes, I understand exactly what you're saying, because I was a little bit lost in what it meant to be a New Zealander. I had gone away and had returned to a country that I didn't recognise, and I didn't know how to fit into this country that I was born into, and I needed to do some soul searching on what it actually meant to be a New Zealander and what that culture meant to me, because I wasn't identifying with it. And it was our filmmakers that I actually turned to. Storytellers that I wanted to see and understand what they were saying about that. And I understand what you're saying, because the writings of Merata Mita really did help me to understand that. Yeah, I don't know if I came up with a definitive answer, but I realised that it wasn't easy to define what it meant to be a New Zealander, but I came to understand how I could understand it for myself and what my part in this country was. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing to come out of that for me, that change and that we go through, was the excitement of being part of the development that was going on.
Yes.
We have lived through very fluid times, and the richness that signaled was available to us. I have just found really, really exciting.
I'm also looking through your screenography, and I paused also on a short film made in 1996 called Altamaiti, of which you were the editor. I think that's one of the most beautiful short films I've ever seen in my life.
Yes, it's beautiful, isn't it?
It really, really is quite stunning. And again, it changed my perception of life as I knew it. and it was introduced, I was doing some training at Avalon Studios, and it was introduced to me by a woman named Pamela Meeking-Stewart, who had been making a lot of documentaries. And it was something that she thought was absolutely stunning too, and she shared it with our class, and it left us quiet and speechless for quite a long time. There was a woman in the class who was Samoan, who said, "I don't want to say what I think about this film. I want to know what you all think about this film."
Yes.
Like, again, putting that mirror up. I love that our stories and our storytellers can generate such great discussion and reflection as well.
Yes. Sima Urale was the director of Altamaiti, and I loved working with her. It was cut on film, of course.
Yes.
But it was like cutting butter with a hot knife. It was so easy to cut. Mm. She knew exactly what she was doing.
Wow. Now, lingering on me being down at Otago, that's just made me think about the work that you've done with Robert Sarkis, because, you know, yes, he's made Scarface and he made Out of the Blue, both films, yep, very much Dunedin stories. What's it been like working with Robert?
Well, Robert is a perfectionist. He's really interesting, because if you sort of read the script of Scarface, you think, oh, this is a film for university students, and it's a bit of a romp and stuff like that. However, the underlying thing that's sitting inside that film is how easy it is to slip into darkness, yeah, into darkness of how you solve something, of forgetting about how other people feel and think. And in every film that I worked with Rob, there has been an underlying story happening,
yeah,
underneath what's there superficially, and it's the always really nutty sorts of problems that humans face. And the other thing about Rob is that he doesn't ever say that's good enough. And it was from Rob that I learnt that a film is never finished until the film is finished.
Wow.
Wow. So he don't stop until he's completely satisfied and he's got what he wants.
That's an amazing thing to live up to, setting yourself such high targets like that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a wonderful director.
I'm going to make a point of actually having a conversation with him sometime, because I'm fascinated by people that set themselves those sort of high perfectionist ideals with their art. You know, that's a really interesting thing to pursue in a conversation. Well,
perhaps we can combine a little bit of Rob if you're bringing me into the Wairarapa Film Festival, because
yeah,
undoubtedly one of his films may be screening or something.
There's always links. That's what I've discovered since doing the Wairarapa Film Festival, that there's always somebody in the audience that steps forward and says, can I tell you about a film that I was involved in the Wairarapa a few years ago?
Yes.
The connections are always really incredible. Now, yeah. Jamie Selkirk, who's also a Masterton man. Now, this is somebody that you went on to work with as part of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So, in particular, you worked closely with him on The Two Towers. What were you working with him around the editing of that?
In fact, Jamie was not the editor of The Two Towers. Mike Horton was.
Ah.
But Jamie edited the last film, The Return of the King.
That is it. Right. Great.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, the last one was what was in my head, so thank you for that. And I'm interested in, again, the two Masterton people working together on what was, of course, a huge international film.
Yeah.
What was the weight of that like? Because you had three films within a short space of time to work on, to edit, to get out to the world. I mean, what was that kind of responsibility like?
Responsibility wasn't all mine, that's for sure. Editorial department for Lord of the Rings was 14 people.
Gosh, yeah.
And there were three main editors. The first one was John Gilbert for film one, Mike Wharton for film two, and Jamie Selkirk for film three. But the interesting thing was that two of those editors, Mike and Jamie, had grown up on film, and they neither of them crossed over into working on computers. So when they, when both of them edit, and Mike, and this is still true for Mike Wharton, they use an operator to actually do the physical work with the computer while they sit right next door to you and are going, you know, we'll take that shot and then we'll have that one and then we'll have that one and take, you know, and take a couple of seconds off the front there and five frames off the back there and, you know, and they give you a fair amount of freedom, but that's how it works. So on film three, I was Jamie's hands.
Ah, I see. I understand. Yeah. Gosh. Yeah.
So it's you're right in there and right doing the stuff, but it's Jamie who is the editor, and it's Jamie who won the Oscar.
Mm. And I and through your hands and the CEO.
What's really, really good is that those two editors, and now only Mike Wharton, that's the only person that an editor can actually apprentice themselves to.
Oh, there we go. That's, yeah, you know, an example of somebody that's actually like apprenticing and mentoring.
At the same time. And, yeah, and it happens because you're in there and this person's head is right alongside you and you're inside that head.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Amazing way to learn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For Return of the King was basically edited during 2003. However, before that time, we had footage coming in, of course, right through the year 2000, and that needed an assembly editor because Jamie wasn't available. He was also the post-production producer and had a huge amount of other work on that he was looking after besides running the whole of editorial. And he needed an assembly editor to start putting together the footage for Return of the King so that the crews and Peter could find out whether they had all the footage that they needed, etc. And that's the work that I did as well.
That must have been a huge chunk of your life working on the trilogy.
It was a huge chunk of a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, I can imagine. I want to come into now your work with Paul Wolfram and the film Māori Māori, which is currently being presented as part of Whānau Marama New Zealand International Film Festival. We have one screening in Masterton, and I'm delighted that a group of you will be present to talk to the audience after the screening. I'm going to turn it into a panel discussion because we have Paul Wolfram, your good self, as the editor, Evelyn Kunder, the film's subject, and we also have one of the film's co-producers coming along as well. So it's going to be a really interesting and lively discussion after the screening, and I'm really looking forward to that. How did you come to be involved? Because I understand that this is the second film that you've worked with Paul. What was the first film?
The first film was Ngā Reo o Te Whenua, The Voices of the Land. And that was a beautiful piece of work. It was on the taonga pōro, the traditional Māori instruments. The way that they are the connection between human and gods.
Oh, wow. The Atua.
Yeah. And it followed Richard Nunes, Richard Nunes and Hulunu Milbourne were the people who sort of reinvigorated Taonga Pu'oro for the nation. And I was very impressed with Paul's attitude to handling that sort of material, because Paul is primarily or originally, I think I get this right, a music
ethnologist.
Thank you.
I think that's how you pronounce it. But yeah, he studies
ethnologist.
Indigenous music, and he's spent the last 20 years, I understand, off and on working with communities in the Pacific Islands and in Papua New Guinea. And I think that's where he ended up hearing stories of what was happening up in the highlands while he was in the lowlands of Papua New Guinea, actually making documentaries and doing studies of indigenous music in Papua New Guinea. It obviously was a mutually gratifying experience, because he got you back again for the edit for Māori Māori. What was that like working in the studio? Because Evelyn, one of the films, the film's Beating Heart, was in the studio with you, I understand, too.
You mean in the edit suite?
Yes, yeah.
Yes, Evelyn came out in September last year for maybe 5 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, and we were at that stage getting towards the end of the edit and needed the really fine tuning on the interpretation. The translation, because the entire film had to be, I had to work with translations all the way through, and the nuance of translating something into English, it can be very, very fine before you get in order to in order to truthfully portray what the person speaking is actually saying, to get the fineness of the feeling and the emotion behind what is happening, and so it was great to have Evelyn in the edit suite for the time she was here.
That sounds like a really important part of the process, because in that way that you've got that sort of real participatory partnership happening with making a film. Yes. Yeah, really, really important.
It is, especially when you're working across languages.
You don't want to get that wrong.
No, you don't want to get it wrong. And it's not just making sure that the technical words are correct, it's making sure that the emotion and the feel is being portrayed.
Is this a new experience for you to be working at that kind of language level when you're editing?
No, not at all. I have worked across language and across culture, cross-culturally, ever since before Patu, and almost the second, third year of my training.
Wow.
Barry Barclay's documentary, The Neglected Miracle, we had, I think, about six languages at least. Happening on that one.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating and really, really interesting to be working across language, across culture, because they it's that nuance thing. It's finding a way of not just having the words correct, but actually having the images also portraying the emotion.
The emotion and the feeling of the language.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Oh, gosh. I think that a lot of people could learn a lot from you, Annie.
Well, yeah.
Hence why I need you at the Wired Upper Film Festival next year. I really do believe that that would be an amazing experience for all the people that come along desperate. I mean, you saw in the masterclasses how eager people are just to sit and listen and learn from people that have been doing this work in the industry and important storytelling for long periods of time. The masterclasses are great for that.
Yeah, and it's one of the things which I have felt over the last eight years at least is that my purpose now, because this is my 50th year of editing, my purpose is actually not to run around editing films all the time. I have been looking at making sure that the skills that I have are being passed on, and the part of the skills is the philosophy and the attitude and the process of how you work. It's not all the flash razzmatazz that appears on the screen. It's the other stuff, the thinking and the philosophy that goes on behind it. And that is the real importance of having worked with people like Mira Tamita and Barry Barclay, Tomo Puata, and Rob Sarkis, these people who are thinking not on just one level of a story, they are thinking on about 3 to 4 levels through in the film. You pick off the top layer and you find actually there's something else underneath, and underneath that layer there's something else as well. And that's what makes it interesting. But you don't get that from being really fast and jazzy. You get that from sitting and watching and thinking.
Yeah, the observing and the and watching and thinking, but also feeling. You experience the story with all of your senses. I really do believe in that.
Yeah.
It's been an absolute delight to talk to you today, Annie. Well, I'll be doing that again really soon. So just for everyone who's listening, please come along to the special screening of Māori Māori, which is happening at Regent 3 Cinemas Masterton on Saturday, the 31st of August at 2:30 p.m. I look forward to seeing you then, Annie.
Thanks very much, Jane.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you too.
Ngā mihi nui.
Ngā mihi nui ki a koe.